All right, the lesson that we're going to do now is going to be titled God's Plan for Godly Parents. And I want to make some observations here from observations that I've made over a number of years and have been a parent for, I've had some experience. When I was young, I had parents. And then I got married and I became a parent. And then our kids grew up and left, and so now we're grandparents. So I do have considerable experience. But here's the interesting thing. Do you ever think about this? Inexperience versus experience as far as being a parent is concerned. Parents become the most knowledgeable at parenting when their last child leaves home. That's curious, isn't it? Parents are least knowledgeable when their first child is born. So that parents grow in parenting skill when their children are home, when their children are present. So it makes you question, who's really training who? And when is it necessary, you know, to be a competent parent? I know when we became parents at in fact, I think our doctors even gave us books, you know, on parenting. And who was that guy, Dr. So-and-so?
Spock.
Dr. Spock. Our kids are being born, anybody know Dr. Spock? Okay. When our kids are being born, every parent got a Dr. Spock book. And you read that Dr. Spock book. Then, of course, after your kids are grown, you find out that Dr. Spock, he missed it completely. I mean, he absolutely didn't have a clue, and we might even be looking at generations that have come as a result of that. I don't know. But let's think about it. Competence versus, we talk inexperience versus experience. It seems to work in reverse. Competence versus incompetence, because we all want to be a competent parent. But competence is not universal, because no advice, no counsel, no textbook precisely fits your child. You notice that? Every child's different. And every child has to have, you learn different things about raising each child. And so you can't pass competence on. Skills required to parent one child are unique to that child. And they oftentimes don't really pass on to the parenting of other children. I've noticed that in my own home. We've had a number of children in our home. The parenting that I would use with one child would be completely different than the parenting I would use to another. Actually, it turns out to be the same. Most of you know Amy. Many of you know Amy. And Amy was a child, as a child, was just an agreeable child. And my kids would come home from college and whatnot, you know, and they would see the way I treated Amy, and they would tell me, says, Dad, it says, you used to spank us. You never spank Amy. How come you never spank Amy? I said, well, I really treated you all the same. I spanked you when you needed it. She didn't need any spanking. She was a kid when she got up to be a teenager. She was a kid that if she's going to be late home from school, she called us up and let us know. When she went over to her friend's house and be longer than she expected, she called us up and let us know. Okay? I don't blame that on parenting or credit even to parenting. Kids are different and they require different parents. And so it's an idea. Competence is not universal. Even when you think you have it, it doesn't fit the next child that comes along. Competence also is not transferable. Otherwise, you know, if we could transfer our competence to the next generation, then the present generation should be the best parenting generation in the history of mankind, right? But it's not. What happened to all the stuff people learned in the past and tried to pass on? Well, it has to start over with each generation. So that parents then, you know, what do? we start out knowing nothing. And then we start learning how to be parents until finally our last child leaves home. And now I know everything there is to know about parenting, and I don't have any children at home. So what do? I try to advise my children on how to raise my grandchildren. And do you think they will listen to me? Okay, no. They will completely ignore everything I have learned and all the expertise that I have. Forget it. It does not going to, you know, be listened to. So it's a curious thing. I guess what we come to the conclusion is this. Competence as being a parent is a non-essential. And it's God's plan. God gives children to incompetent parents and then takes them away when the parents gain competence. Do you suppose God knows what he's doing? Remind you of Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23. Jeremiah said, I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. It's God's will that inexperienced, incompetent people have children. And it's God's will that competent people give up their children. And that's the way it works. Now, can we have good parenting? Well, yeah, we can. We can do that. You know, we're going to be accountable as parents. God holds parents accountable for their parenting. He gives us children, he puts them into our care, and brethren, we will be accountable for the care that those children get. We'll give an accountant unto God. God will judge parents, now, according to their ability to perform. And for that matter, let's talk about, can we be a perfect parent? Well, no, you'll not be a perfect parent. We learn by our mistakes, don't we? And I have to say that. I made more mistakes with my firstborn than I did with my lastborn because I knew more about children, knew how to do it. So I made most of my mistakes with my firstborn child. But you want to know something? My firstborn child is the most mature, the one most able to deal with life and with the problems of life than are my last-born children. Now, not that any of them are lacking or whatnot, but I just noticed the child that learns that I am imperfect is the child that grows up first, and they don't expect so much. But the last child that was born, I have to say with Amy, our last-born, she thought, I put it like this, in her real younger years, she knows better now, she thought I was God. I could do no wrong. See, because I was a good, competent parent. Remember the time, Janice, when she decided she, one of the fellows in our congregation, good-looking man, not really charming man, and she was driving home with Janice one day, and she said, I want to marry Jim. When I grow up, I'm going to get married to Jim. And Janice says, well, Amy, she says, Jim already has a wife. Oh, a little while later, she says, okay, then I'm going to marry God. She says, well, Amy, God doesn't have a wife. He says, that's why I'm going to marry him. So she felt very qualified to be in the presence of God. She thought her dad was perfect. And she knows better now, but that's in the beginning. My firstborn son, he never had any notion about my perfection. Okay. I mean, he knew. I made mistakes practically every day, and I would go to bed at night and regret what I did or what I said or decisions I made and everything and really work with it, and yet he turned out okay. What happens then? All the child expects of you is your best. And they know it. They know. If you're doing your best, and that's all they want. So, children don't expect parents to be perfect. The knowledge that they're doing their best is enough. That's all they need. And that's all you have to set out to do. Parenting is an important aspect of family, and you should set out to do the best job you can do. That means you're going to take it seriously, and that means every day and every word and every step you take that you're going to do your best to raise these children as they should be raised. God put them under your oversight, and you can do it. You can do that. And the responsibility then is going to be, in the sight of God, something that we will give answer for. So, let's look here at our passage in the book of Ephesians, chapter 6 and verse 4. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger or to wrath, your translation may say, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Who is this instruction directed to? Fathers. Not mothers. Fathers. Why is that? Why is that? It seems like our wives are, they instinctively, it seems to me, deal better with children. They have more compassion for the children. They're able to relate to the children, it seems to me, better than the guys do. Guys have to work at that and learn how. Why then didn't God say, mothers, you mothers now, you bring your children up, you do this, don't provoke them unto wrath? Why is it directed to the father? And the answer is in the last lesson. Because the father is the head of the family. And the father is the one that will give answer for the parenting and the upbringing of the children. Guys, we're going to answer for that. You can't pass that off to your wife and say, well, she's better at it than I am. She's got more time at it than I am. And I've got to be gone. I've got to work. And I've got to do all these things. So let her do the parenting. Well, She's probably better at parenting than you are. I have to admit that. But the thing is, that's your responsibility. And what goes on in that home, you will answer for. And how those children are raised, you will stand before the judgment seat of God and give answer to God for how those children are raised at the home. You will answer for that. And if you're going to answer for that, look, it'd be a good idea if you got involved. It'd be a good idea if you knew what was happening. It'd be a good idea if you were knowing what's going on with these children and how they're being raised and what their problems are and all of these things. Fathers, provoke not your children unto wrath. So it is directed toward the father. But while it's directed toward the father, listen, it includes the wholeness of the family. Okay, there's no doubt about that. The father's going to give answer for everything, but certainly the responsibility there does rest upon each member of the household. Perhaps more so upon the wife than it does the mother, than it does upon anybody, because more often than not, the opportunity to do the child raising, you know, is more in hand of mom than it is of dad because of the nature of their being absent or working or this kind of thing. And I know things are changing, adjusting in our modern society. We have to be aware of all those things. But there will be a household responsibility. And this will maintain a very important aspect here of the mother's dealing there in that parenting job. I mean, for example, in the book of 1 Timothy, chapter 2, and in the 15th verse. You can't avoid this. This is the way which God has created men and women, that there is such a thing as motherhood. In 1 Timothy, chapter 2, and verse 15, remember the passage there? Let me get that in mind. But women will be preserved through the bearing of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. Okay? The bearing of children. and the raising them up, that they will continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. Certainly that is an aspect of parenting that God has given to the mother. Okay, there's no doubt about that. So we're not going to say there is no responsibility and there is no judgment as far as mothers are concerned. No, there's just as much judgment there. But I think perhaps it's aimed toward fathers because they're the head of the house, and it's so easy for a father to say, okay, Mom, you take care of the kids, I'm out of here. Okay, and you know, and sometimes that happens. We have to have that happen. You know, it'll happen in military families where the dad is in the military and he could be gone for months and months at a time and be absent. It's okay. That's the way life is, and that's the way it works out. But you know what? If there's extraordinary circumstances that the family are having to deal with, then there are extraordinary efforts that have to be put forth to manage that. And that husband still, he still has to stay in contact, and he still has to know what's going on in the family, what's happening with the kids, what's going, you know, what are you having to deal with? And the mom has to know that he's there, he's supportive, and he knows what's going on, and he's being a part. We have to make extraordinary effort in such a case as that. And that's the way it is. I've read biographies of some of the old pioneer preachers, and some of those men, I mean, they really, at great sacrifice, would go out and travel around and hardly any support and constantly traveling and preaching all over and really, you know, doing a great work in proclaiming the Word of God and leaving Mom home all by herself to raise the kids. And you have to wonder about that, don't you? They're doing a great work in God, but they might be neglecting their family. And they'll stand in judgment for that. There'll be a judgment day, and they'll stand before that because, guys, you cannot pass that obligation to your wife and leave her there alone, having to manage all of that, that immense responsibility on herself. And they're, you know, women can do it and accomplish that, and they're wonderfully talented, God made it that way. But the guys cannot step out of the picture. They've got to be involved, and they've got to be there. And then, in a family, if you have, I noticed in our family, we've had times when we've had many kids at home, that certainly this distributes throughout the whole household. All the households' members participate in parenting, don't they? You know, if you have an only child, you might not recognize that, but I tell you what, you start getting child two and three and four, and they go up there, then you recognize that the younger children learn by observing the conduct of the older children. They see the treatment and the responses of the older children to their parents, and they're learning from that. So they're participating in the parenting of those children. Older children in the home are learning by being given responsibility to care for the younger children and this kind of thing. So they're learning and they're taking and participating in that. All of them should respect and cooperate with the fact that the father is the head of that household and is responsible for it, and this should always be recognized. In this passage here in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, it says, "Fathers, provoke not your children unto wrath." My other translation would say, and this one says, "unto anger." And let's just talk about that for a moment. Let's talk about, first of all, about the environment that the child is to grow up in. And that is, it could be an environment of anger and of strife. And this certainly is something that should not be. This is a warning that's given to the parents to say, don't bring your children up in an atmosphere of anger and of strife, because that's going to promote anger and strife in their life to come. Because basically, they're going to learn how to behave in society by the manner in which things go along in home. And if the home is a matter of screaming and hollering and anger and threatening, then that's what we're turning loose into society when we turn our kids away from home. Listen, parents. And from what I've observed, this advice isn't even needed, but maybe you have noticed this sometimes. And that is that children are so clever, right? They learn what their parents are up to. And they learn how to extend the parents' patience right to the limit. And they learn, and they know. Okay. I think they're a lot smarter than we are sometimes. A child will know by the tone of the parent's voice when it's time to obey. They know. So that if you say to your child, "Johnny, it's time to put your toys away and get ready to go to bed." And Johnny sits there and looks at you and just plays with his toys. And you say, "Johnny, it's time to put your toys away and go to bed." Johnny just keeps playing with his toys. And about 3 times later, then you look and say, "Johnny, you get those toys away and get in that bed!" Johnny says, "Okay, it's time to obey." Because he knows by Dad's tone of voice when it's time to obey. And so as a parent, we need to learn, well, what is the tone of voice you want to learn, you want your child to obey? You have to teach them that. You say, "Well, I want them to obey when I speak to them the first time. Or I want them to obey when I speak to them the 10th time in a screaming voice." Okay, which way you want to have it? Do it that way, because they'll learn and they'll know. Let's put it like this. What tone of voice do you want to use to get your child to obey you when you're out at the supermarket? Okay? That's the tone of voice they learn at home. When you see somebody screaming their head off at their kid in the supermarket, you know, and that parent's completely embarrassed and humiliated by it, well, that's what the child learns at home. And they don't know the difference. They'd do the same way in the supermarkets they do at home. They'll not be embarrassed by it. So train your child up, not by provoking them unto anger. And this should be by the family attitude too, not by just how we talk to our children, but certainly by the disposition that we have as a husband and wife toward one another. How do we get along with one another? Are we yelling and angry with one another? Are we insulting one another and this kind of thing? And then we're going to teach our kids good manners? It's not going to work, is it? Because they're going to learn by that disposition. Do not provoke your children unto wrath. And then we can look at that from the point of view of a spiritual wrath. Okay, the spiritual wrath. The child who learned to submit to parental authority has learned to submit to God's authority. And if we can't teach them to submit to our authority at home, it's going to be awfully hard for them to submit unto God's authority later on in life. And if they can't submit to God's authority, then they're going to end up in wrath, right? So by how we treat our kids at home can affect the manner in which they're going to live their life in the future. And so a child then learns to submit to parental authority. That's our job, really, at home, is to instruct them and to teach them that. A child who only reacts to the desire of the flesh is more likely to become a child of wrath. Okay. So how do you raise your children? And I suspect, because I've done all this, that there are times that you have bribed your child for good behavior. Okay? "I'll give you ice cream if you mind. Okay? And if you behave, then you'll get to go and play this game, or you'll get to do that." And so we spend our time bribing them to behave well. Where the fact of the matter is, they should behave well because it's the right thing to do. Okay? And so let's start putting some of that, if we haven't already, let's put some of that in our home. Let's put some of that into our home. For example, we will talk about a little later on about indiscipline. And I don't want to do it just yet, but I want to cite that. You can have what? Corporal punishment? Or what's the other word for that? Non-corporal, I guess. Corporal punishment is when you might spank them or give them, you know, extra physical pain upon them. And the other type of punishment is we'll take something away from them, or we will restrict them, or something of that order. And in those things, I think we need to be careful to exhibit to our children, you know, the proper respect for parental authority. For example, if my little Johnny gets to throwing the ball around in the living room and he knocks my heirloom vase that's been in the family for 10 generations and he knocks it off the table over there and it shatters on the floor. What do I do? I mean, that was the most important thing in the household to me, and now little Johnny broke it. So what am I going to do? Okay, here's where you have to figure it out. What did little Johnny do that was bad? Breaking the lamp? Uh-uh. Can't punish him for breaking the lamp. If it's okay for little Johnny to play with his soccer ball in the living room and he happened to break the lamp, then he did not violate your authority. But if you told him, don't kick the soccer ball in the living room, and then it broke the lamp, then he can be disciplined for violating parental authority. And that's the only reason that you can discipline that child. You cannot discipline the child because you're angry at them. Matter of fact, you should not discipline a child when you are angry at them. It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of, Johnny, I told you not to kick your ball in here, and now I'm going to have to, I mean, if you want to spank or whatever, if you want to take their ice cream cone away from them or their video game away from them or something, you know, that whatever you do, it's a matter that you're training them up to submit to authority. That's what the crime is. That's what the thing is. So that when they go out into society, they can recognize authority and they can respond to it. They can recognize God's authority and they can respond to it. So that basically, I think, is what parents are going to be doing. We find here in our passage in Ephesians chapter 4, and Excuse me, I did that wrong. All right. Oh, it works better if I get in the right verse here. I'm sorry. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26. okay. Yeah, be you angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And you see there is a controlling of anger itself is not a sin. But it's learning to control that anger, to maintain that anger until such time as it subsides, because it's out of anger that we do things that are wrong, isn't it? Because that limits our self-control and our self-limitations. And certainly this is what a child's going to have to learn at home. And so a child needs to learn how to control that anger, how to get over that anger. And believe me, I know that's absolutely so frustrating to parents to figure that out. Because some children will just, I mean, they can just get angry and explode. Other children can hold it in, and you don't recognize it until later that this child is actually seething with anger, but they're not showing it, and you have to deal with that kind of thing. Or some children are just slow to anger. So you have to recognize that, and then you have to recognize how that you discipline them in accord with how that is working within them. And I know there's been times when I always thought I could discipline every child exactly the same. I found out you can't. Because, one, you could discipline with a stern voice, and they would be completely just deflated by that because you were annoyed at them or disapproved of them. Another one, you might have to exert a little something that was uncomfortable upon them so that they would get the idea that you were disapproving of them. But even at that, some of them won't even show that they cared that you disciplined them, and then you find out later that they really did care. We had one child that you couldn't make cry. And then one time I disciplined her and walked out of the room and went back in the room. She's sitting crying. She would not cry. Well, I disciplined her. Had to learn. Made a mistake. I had to learn when she was disciplined. And I had to learn that because she's different than all the others. Let's look at another aspect here. The idea of provoking them unto wrath. That's in Ephesians 6 and in verse 4. The comparable verse to that is Colossians 3 and verse 21. It says, lest they become discouraged. So don't provoke them unto wrath, but nurture them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Or the chastening and the admonition of the Lord. Let's draw a contrast there, because the idea of provoking is put as the counterpoint of nurturing. He says, don't provoke them unto wrath, but nurture them in the admonition and the chastening of the Lord. So by looking at the idea of nurturing them, we see what the conflict, the opposite of that is, in what would be provoking them. All right, now look, to nurture them, well, that's pretty obvious, we'll talk about that. But what's the opposite of nurturing your child? Neglect. When you neglect your child, now I'll put this down to say, you read this passage like that. When you neglect the needs of your child, you are provoking them unto wrath. That may be the key to the whole passage. Neglecting your children is provoking your children and discouraging your children and provoking them unto wrath. So, instead of provoking them unto wrath, let's nurture them in the admonition of the Lord. The expression there, of the Lord, I think is critical in that. The idea of nurturing one is to provide nutrition for it. I mean, that's basically the idea of the word. The nutrition might be in the form of, spiritual nutrition, could be physical nutrition, social growth, whatever the child can grow in. You can nurture that. That is, provide nutrition for that. And the idea there is emphatic of growth. That we're looking forward as we look to the child's needs and how we deal with them, it's always looking to the outcome. It's looking in the direction that we want to go and want the child to be moving, so that we provide the essential environment, let's say, for the child to grow in. We provide the elements to grow, for growth. So we give the environment and we give the elements. It's physical growth. We give them good food to eat, things such as that. But we provide the elements of growth, and then we provide the opportunity for the child to grow. So you don't maintain just where the child is now and in their growth, and you know this as parents, but you're looking forward to the time when they will be growing in another area and anticipating that. A simple illustration of that one is, did your kid ever come home from school with a spelling list and say, what do I have to know how to spell stuff for? What good is that? I don't see any reason why I should have to spell stuff. Even today it's even more particular because they have spell checkers. And then I've noticed on texting and whatnot, they don't even bother to spell stuff anymore. I mean, so it may be a lost art. I don't know. But then you will say, no, look, you need to learn how to spell stuff now. Because a time's going to come when you're going to turn in a job application or you're going to have to fill out a form or something, and you're really going to have to know how to spell. So what you're doing is then you're providing for their growth. You're providing the opportunity to growth before they're there. And you do that. You can figure it out. You do that physically. You do that socially. You do that spiritually for your children. All these areas of growth that the child's going to have. But to neglect the child's growth and development is to provoke them unto wrath. Okay, just as sure as that. Parents need to take parenting seriously. So it's emphatic of growth, so, and it also has an expectation to it. That we are raising and dealing with our children now expecting a mature outcome. We're looking forward to a mature outcome. We don't expect them to be mature now, but we want them on the pathway of growth. At the end of that pathway is they're going to be fully grown, that they're going to be on their own, and they're going to be able to take care of themselves and be a productive member of society and all of these things. So it is then emphatic of maturity when we talk about nurturing our children. We're laboring now with the outlook to the future. We act now with a clear objective in view, is what we are doing in raising our children. So perfecting, let's say, perfect parenting works itself out of a job. That's called inherent obsolescence. Obsolescence, how do you pronounce that? You see that? While you're raising your children to be mature and complete, you're preparing yourself to be obsolete. Right? You work yourself out of a job. And sometimes parents can't deal with that. You know, you've heard of the idea of cutting the apron strings. We need to learn. Those are apron strings, not apron springs. Okay, we need to let go and not be pulling them back. They need to go, and they need to be prepared to go, and they need to be able to deal with life and this kind of thing. And so the parents got to be looking forward to these kinds of things. And what kind of things do we help our children to grow in? Look at the passage over in Luke chapter 2 and verse 52. With regard to the growth and the maturity of Jesus from the time when he was a child. And it gives a description of the kind of growth that Jesus had as a child, and I think gives us some insight into the kind of growth that we all, everybody, is involved in. Okay, the book of Luke, chapter 2, and in the last verse of that chapter, it says, "And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and in favor with man." Wisdom and stature, in favor with God and with favor with man. Every individual has an intellect. Every individual has in stature is physical. Every individual has to grow in favor with God, that's spiritual. Every individual has to grow in favor with man, that's social, right? That's what we're made of. That's what a person is made of. So when you're raising your children, you have to realize to nurture the child, you have to nurture the whole child. That is from the physical and the social. We teach them how to get along with one another and others. We give them social training. And with the wisdom, that is intellect, we send them to school, we teach them, they grow in knowledge and everything, and in spirit. Spiritual growth. Parent, you are responsible for the spiritual growth of your child. God forbid, as parents so often have done, as to say, well, I don't insist on my child to learn anything about God. Because if you do that, when they grow up, they're just going to turn away from God. I'm going to feed them all the food they need, and I'm going to insist they eat their spinach, and so on. I'm going to take them to the doctor when they're sick, and I'm going to get them ministered. I'm going to insist they do their homework and that they go to school, but I'm not going to insist that they learn about God. That's called neglect. And neglect provokes unto wrath. Think about it. What's the most important aspect of your child? Is it the physical aspect of the child, the social aspect, the intellectual aspect, or the spiritual aspect? Take them in order. Which one of those is the most important? Anybody going to disagree with me when I say aspect number one is the spiritual aspect of the child? That's the one that comes first. So when it comes time to say, well, do we go to the special school activity because that's important for their intellectual well-being, or do we take our child to the gospel meeting because that touches their spiritual well-being? How many of us have said, well, we had to go to school tonight. They had a special program at school, and so there are children. We send them off there, and that's why they can't come to Bible class. You think about it. Are you nurturing your child? Or are you teaching them, look, if you serve God the best you can, but look, when things come up in life that are more interesting or more important or more demanding, well, go do those things because the Lord's work is always going to be there and you can always get in it later. Is that the way we're going to think about parenting? Or should we tell the child, the most important part of your life is your relationship to God? You do that first. It's more important than anything else, and you don't let anything else interfere with that. Those are decisions that we are helping our children to learn when they're growing up so that when they get out into society, they'll be able to deal and take care of themselves spiritually. I'll relate to you a personal incident with one of our children. She in high school, she was in the journalism class. And she came home one day, and she knew the answer, but she came home and she had a problem. She said, well, the only time they can get the printing press down at the newspaper seems to be on Wednesday night, and the teacher wants the kids to come down there on Wednesday night and work on their school paper that they're working on. And she said, I told the teacher that I had Bible class on Wednesday night, and the teacher said, look, if you want to get a passing grade, you better be there at that special thing. And so she said, what am I going to do? She knew, but she wanted reinforcement. And so I told her, I said, look, we'll put the Lord's work first. And I'll tell you what, if that teacher gives you a failing grade, they're going to have an angry parent down there talking to them about what's going on. And so the next day she went in and she came out home after school. I said, well, what happened? She said, well, I told the teacher that I couldn't make it in on Wednesday. And he said, that's okay. You go ahead and come in on Thursday. She took a stand. Oh, okay, look. She learned something at home. She learned something at home that she could take with her when she left home and went out into life. And that same daughter of mine, when she went to Florida College, and during one of the breaks or something, they had holidays, well, she and a bunch of her classmates, they took the car from where they were at school, and they drove up out of state to one of the kids' houses, and they spent the weekend or something and the holiday at one of those homes. And then they were driving back. It's a long drive back. And they were coming back to, and they were driving back on Sunday. They were driving on the road, got late in the evening on Sunday, and that same daughter said to the other kids in the car, says, there's a congregation that's over here. Why don't we turn over here and go to evening services? And the other kids in the car, he says, well, we're tired, we've got a long way to go, we've got to drive. So he says, let's just go on, we've got to get back, we don't want to get back any later than she had. She says, well, you kids, you go ahead and go on, just drop me off, I will go to services. And so they all went to services. Okay, 79. They all went. She made a decision. And she is going to stick to it, that putting God first in her life is not going to ruin her life. God's going to take care of things, and it's going to work out. It's going to work out best in the end. Nurture them. Nurture them mentally, physically, spiritually, socially. All these things are important. We find then in regard to the idea of serving now, he said, and that was in the nurturing them, in the chastening and the admonition of the Lord. Chastening means discipline. And by the way, big misconception can be found about discipline. And you think that discipline, you say, I failed to discipline a child because I failed to, you know, spank them or something like that. That's only a part of discipline. Discipline covers a whole range of areas. You can have discipline that is to, and let's put it like this. Discipline is strictly for this. Let's put bad stuff over here, good stuff over here. Okay, let's just, if we can somehow separate that. Discipline, its concept is to turn the child from the bad stuff and move them toward the good stuff. So that if the child's doing something bad, you may have to give them some punitive discipline. They need to suffer some consequence for the bad doing. On the other hand, it may be a discipline that is corrective discipline. That is just simply to say, look, rather than doing this, let's do it this way. And we start correcting them. But what are we doing? We're turning them away from the bad toward the good. And then we get them going toward the good. Let's say they're moving in the good. Then we have to understand that we want to prevent some of the bad stuff. So you have preventive discipline. So that you teach your kids, say, look, you know, drugs are, they're not going to be exposed to drugs. But you say, you know, there's a lot of drugs and stuff going around, and you really want to avoid that kind of thing. And so you have a preventive discipline. But then you get, that's all in from the bad point of view. Now let's look toward the good point of view and getting them moving that direction. And so you will have then, you're going to prepare them. Let's call it preparative discipline. You're going to instruct them and give them the skills to walk and to do in the good direction. And then you're going to have instructive discipline, where you're going to instruct them and teach them. Sometimes the kids will call that nagging them. But you know, you will instruct them, and you're going to keep telling them and say, be careful how you drive, and do this, and say, Mom, I already know how to drive. I know what, I just want you to think about it and have it conscious in your mind, you know. And so we have instructive discipline, and then we have confirmative discipline, and that's in when they're doing something good, doing it well, then you're saying, hey, that's really good. I'm really proud of you for what you are doing. And we have to mix that in. We don't want to spend our whole time, you know, telling them what they're not doing right. We have to spend some of our time complimenting them on what they are doing right. All that's designed with one thing. We want the flow of development to turn away from that which is unacceptable and move it in the direction of that which is acceptable. And this is what the Bible has in mind when it's talking about chastening. The chastening then, there's a purpose in chastening, and the purpose is always to be moving in the proper direction. We go to 12 here, don't we? In our time, what is our time? I forgot how we started at 9:30 now. I mean, what would your standard time be?
12 is fine.
Huh? 12
is fine.
Okay, 12 will be fine. All right. So let's look over here then in the book of Hebrews, if I can find my passage here now, Hebrews chapter 12, because It's always, we have so much that relates to parenting. Jesus relates to the church. The husbands and wives learn from that. And then God is our Father. We are His children. And how God treats His children is a manner in which we are going to be able to know how we should treat our children. Let's look at this. I think a good passage is Hebrews chapter 12 and then verse 5. It says, "And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. It's, my son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord." And some would translate that as chastening. "Nor faint when you are reproved by him, for those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines." Whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. So here is an aspect here that God, because he has love for us, that he's going to discipline us. He says it's for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. And what son is there of whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. See, if you haven't been disciplined, you don't have parents. Parents, you are not parents until you discipline your children. And without that, there's no love. There's no love in that particular arrangement. Now look here in verse 9. It says, "Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live?" We are chastened or we are disciplined so that we can live. We want our children to live, don't we? And so we teach them how it is that they can get by in life, how they can survive, how they can be healthy, and how they can go forward. And spiritually, we teach them how to live eternally. And I know many of us have children that have grown up and have not accepted the pathway of Christ. And I know that you worry about that, and I know it's upsetting to you, and we have to deal with that in our own family. The point is that you can't force a child to accept God, but you can certainly teach them where God is. So that if they go out in life and they stray away from God, friends, when they want to turn back to God, they know where to go. That's what we give them as parents. When they go out and if they stray away, we want them to know. They turn away from that pathway and they want to find something better in their life, they'll know where to go. And that's what we're going to do. We'll teach them. And as he says, we're going to teach them on the pathway of life. Then as we read down in this passage, let's see in verse 10. "For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good so that we may share his holiness." So here is the aspect here, that the disciplining there is that thing that's going to be training us, it's going to be directing us in the pathway of holiness, in the pathway of God. So they're going to learn to live, they're going to be trained to live, so to speak. And then we go on here in this 11th verse, that all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful, yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So there is a discipline of which the outcome is going to be righteousness. How many of you, some of us who are older, remember the household where we had the woodshed out back? And mom would save the disciplining for dad. And dad came home all worn out and all tired from work, and he came home and now he's got to deal with the problem child. And mom says, "You know what Junior did when you were gone?" And dad's got to deal with that now, and his patience is about gone. And so he says, "Okay, let's go out to the woodshed." We head for the woodshed, and sometimes, you know, Dad would let you pick the stick out that you're going to get your spanking with. And then Dad, remember those famous words? He's going to say, "Son, this is going to hurt me worse than it's going to hurt you." Remember that one? And as a kid, you always thought, "Oh man, I don't know how I can say that, because I know this is going to hurt me bad." And all the anticipation of it, and finally of it, and oh, you just hated that moment. And here I am telling you the story. I'm laughing about that moment. I'm remembering that moment. I don't hate my dad because he did that to me. I love it. I love to tell that story. It's a great story. Dad used to whip me. And you look, the time you hated it, and you say, "That man despises me. How can he say he loves me?" But then afterwards you say, you have the woodshed trips that you remember with fond affection. Why? Because somebody loved you. That's what it was all about. He wanted me to grow up. He wanted me to live. He wanted me to be able to survive. And then the Bible comes along and it says, "Children, obey your parents." We'll do this tomorrow. Obey your parents, because that is a commandment with promise, so that you can live a long time. It's a promise. That's what parents are in the business of doing, is teaching their children how to live physically, socially, intellectually, spiritually. And when it comes to spiritual living, you're talking about eternity. The weight of eternity is bearing upon that. All right, then you have the aspect of admonition comes in later, and we won't spend much time on that except to say that this is the idea. The idea of admonition is technically to simply bring to mind or to make aware of things. It's the admonition. Say, look, this is where you are. This is what's happening. This is what's going on with this. The Apostle Paul had a great description of that. And again, in the terms of a parent dealing with a child, you get a very nice expression of this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And I just read verse 2. We won't go very deeply into this. I want to express something here to you, though. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and in verse 7. Paul said, "We proved to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her children." Discipline must be with affection. And that is, we can deal with affection. And that is the idea there. Let's look at it from this perspective. That a parent does what a parent does, they do it gladly. They don't do it resentfully. We don't come to our children and say, you go out and you get a daytime job, and you go and you work at it for 8 hours, and then you take a break and you get away from it, right? And then you get a weekend away from it. And then you get a vacation just to get away from working. What about the job parents have? You don't get away. You don't have a vacation. And I don't like it when parents say to their children, "Okay, it's time for me to get away and have some time for my own, so I'm going to leave you here and I'm just going to get out here and get away from you kids because I've just about had it with you and I need to go and get regenerated." We do our parenting with affection, and our kids know that we are doing it. We're glad to do it. We don't resent them for taking our time and our effort. We're doing this because it's the most important work upon the face of the earth, and we're here and we're glad we're doing it. It's not like a 9-to-5 job, is it? No, it's a job of dedication and love. It's done with affection. Now, here's the last point I'll make. It's in the 8th verse. And Paul says, "Having so fond an affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives." Now, if you look at that, you probably have a little footnote there on that word lives. And if you look over in the center column over there, and some of your translations will say it, he says, we impart to you not only the gospel of God, but our own soul. I am imparting to my child my soul. Think about the impact of that. What we are giving to our children basically is our soul. Let me put it like this. You're going to put a thumbprint on your child's soul. And that thumbprint will stay there for the rest of their life. When you as a parent are imparting the things and the standards of your life to your child, you're putting a stamp of your values and the things that you hold in faith and in truth. You hold to these things and you're giving that to your child, and your child will never get away from that. Think of that. Put a thumbprint on your child's soul. Okay, thank you for your attention here this morning. Let's go ahead and bring this to a close. Let's get our songbook in hand and open it up to our closing song here. It's number 285. And here is Zion's Call. And this is what we want to remember. We're going to depart from here and go about our life, just like children depart from home, go around their life. You want your child, when they depart from home, you want them to take the consciousness and the values and the things of home with them as they go. And we want to do the same thing right now. We want to say, okay, we're going to leave this room. We're kind of isolated here. We sang some beautiful songs. We prayed together. We read God's Word together. And say, okay, now we'll leave that behind. We'll go out and we'll really get to where life really is. Let's take what we've thought about now with us. And you know, that's what a hymn does. A hymn touches the heart. And your heart will be very tender. And you'll be surprised how that the hymn then will establish and put that little fingerprint of what you've just been doing upon your heart. And it'll go with you in the days to come. So think about the hymn and the message that it has for you. And at the time, if you do have a spiritual need that we can assist you with, encourage or pray for you, we invite you to come forward and let that need be known now while we stand and sing.